There's essentially this obviates any need for the EPA. We're down to 15 seconds. Steve, you want to let people know where they can access this this piece of yours?
Yeah, sure. Well, so this article was up on the Smog blog. It went up over the weekend, and it's titled "Investor Call: Enbridge's Keystone XL Clone Opens in October." Rail facility to follow, and that rail facility is important too, but that's a topic for another day.
Thank you so much for that. Oh my gosh, of course.
Thank you.
You're wonderful. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us on the show today. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, August 18th, 2014. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks for that, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is a KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Welcome back, Kathleen. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Peña Flamenca de Portland on Friday, August 22nd. This month, co-sponsor La Peña Flamenca de Portland presents El Cuadro Gallo. Featuring Christina Lawrence, accompanied by Jeffrey Trapp on guitar, Paul Brady on cante, Nick Hutch on cajon, and Brenna McDonald on palmas. Again, that's La Peña Flamenca de Portland and El Cuadro Gallo on Friday, August 22nd at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
And by Northwest Connector, connecting riders to the Oregon coast through daily road trip bus routes from Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. Northwest Connector buses are equipped with bike racks and offer 3-day and 7-day passes with transfers up and down the coast. Schedules and trip planner at nwconnector.net. And now we will hear part two of the forum on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how this secretive free trade agreement will impact local efforts to ban GMOs. That was recorded on January 19th in Portland. So here we are, part two of the forum on the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
So first off, I want to thank our speakers again for your powerful insights and being here today to share with us. Before we open it up to questions, I just want to talk just a little bit more about the investor chapter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So this is a chapter that was leaked recently by WikiLeaks. And what it would do is allow any law, regulation, or court decision to be challenged by international corporations if they feel like it may impede on their ability to make future profits. So, you know, this is something that's been around since the NAFTA years. It's also under the WTO. This is a chapter under the, or this is a regulation under the WTO. And under the WTO, 90% of the 65 cases brought against the U.S. Have been lost. It's weakened portions of the Clean Air Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the Endangered Species Act. So that's the results of, you know, this corporate investor rights rule. Bringing it back to GMO labeling, under the TPP's investor chapter, it would allow corporations to challenge the labeling as barriers to trade. So already under the WTO, we've seen the U.S. Dolphin Safe Tuna Fish label and meat country of origin meat labels successfully attacked under the by other countries under the WTO. and under the TPP, foreign food producers that are operating within the United States can issue a challenge to our recent wins in Jackson and Josephine, the GMO bans, if they feel like that would impede on their ability to make expected future profits. So that's what we're up against. The TPP would mean a barrage of new attacks on our hard-fought victories on GMO bans and our soon-to-be victory on GMO labeling. That's what's at stake. So with that, I want to go ahead and open it up to questions. If you have questions, if you can come up to the mic, that would be wonderful.
Sorry. Okay. So the question was, she's basically asking what the big deal is about adding just a little bit more information onto a label, because we already require so much labeling, ingredients, nutritional facts, a lot of organic, versus not organic. And this is where when I said substantially equivalent, that's like a very legal phrase that the FDA or USDA? I always get my agencies mixed up, but the government has basically decided to define GMO ingredients as substantially equivalent for the express purpose of not having to label it. I mean, it's the industry's way of making sure that consumers don't have choice, because they're in Europe and European countries where there is labeling, Europeans tend to not purchase GMO ingredient foods. So, and I think that's where there is a huge fear from the industry.
Okay, got it. All right. It sounds to me like this act, whoops, I got to pull this off. Okay. It sounds to me like what's happening here is the countries are giving up their sovereignty and the states are giving up their sovereignty. This act is happening at the national level, and apparently it's interfering with the states being able to control their own destinies. And is there any legal action that can be done to prevent this kind of has there been any attempt to do that? This where the power goes and who can choose their own destinies on these things.
You mean in terms of sovereignty issues? Yeah, I mean,
it seems to me that we're governed by a constitution. It almost sounds like some of that's being filtered away.
Right, because Congress can, sign Congress can approve treaties, right? The president can sign them. That's their constitutional authority. So what they're saying is that these trade agreements, they are authorized under the Constitution to do it. I mean, then it would take all kinds of money, time and energy to take these trade agreements to the Supreme Court, where we don't know if we're going to win them or not. But in the meantime, money that we could use to, it's working. Money that we could be using for other things, other better things, we're using to fight these things when it's a lot easier to stop this trade agreement right where it is in its tracks right now. And to reverse the process. And there are people in Congress who believe that we should renegotiate all of our past, quote, free, quote, trade agreements, including our own Senator Merkley, who's more than willing to do that.
So I would just echo what Madeline said. We really do need to stop these trade deals now before they hit the floor of Congress. And we have been successful in doing this in the past. This isn't our first rodeo. We have been able to organize, it's people-to-people conversations, reaching out to your church, reaching out to your unions, and putting pressure on elected officials, and that kind of organizing has seen huge wins. We were able to defeat the free trade of area of the Americas. You know, you're all familiar with our success with the battle in Seattle in 1999 when we shut down the WTO talks. And we can do it on the TPP too. It's going to take all of us coming together and working on it.
Yeah, I think it's just really important to remember, like, it sounds really bad, and the stuff that's already happened sounds really bad, but this hasn't happened yet. It's not happened yet, right? And that's the whole point, and we really do have the power to make it go away. I mean, we can get members of Congress to not fast track because it's so bad. We can get them to not smart track, hopefully, as well, because it's so bad. And that makes it harder for them to vote yes on the TPP. Our work is still cut out for us, for absolutely sure. But we got to make it really hard for them to publicly support this stuff.
Right. And I have to say that CWA, this is our number one issue. Our number two issue is campaign finances. But our number one issue is the Trans-Pacific Partnership and stopping it. And when we were on Capitol Hill in April, we went to the Republicans, right? Who's the majority of Congress right now? It's not the Ds, it's the Rs. Yeah, we need every single D we can get, and we have to start kicking our congressional butt here. But John Muswick, who's the president of the Medford CWA local, and I went and visited Greg Walden's office. And we were very much warmly welcomed. And they wanted to hear what we had to say. I don't think that's a mistake. I don't think they were shining us on. They really did want to hear what we had to say about it. And I think that this is important. If you have relatives who are in a Republican area, they need to call their Republican representatives and talk to them about this. This could be a key issue in a very important election year that they may be able to side with us on. And I think that it's really important that we try it. So,
yeah.
Definitely. I'm Brian from the Freedom Socialist Party. I agree with you that we need to talk with people. I mean, I just want to point out that our latest paper, the FS, has an editorial about the TPP. So it's something that you can arm yourself with by having this paper in your hand. And when you're talking about talking with people, our lead article is about the Obama's My Brother's Keeper sham, which I think is a good opening to talk with young black people, what they think about it, and getting a dialogue with them to point them in a more radical direction. So having this paper would be a good start. So I have some if people would like, but I certainly agree. And I was talked about the WTO was. Being in a study in economics, a few years before the WTO meeting, I was really depressed. I didn't see any. This is going to affect our future forever, and I. So then, as it got nearer and more people gathered, you know, it was really a big change. It can happen, like you say, and that's. But we have to. Reach out, and it might have to be, like you say, one-on-one, door-to-door, or whatever means we can use. But the people really need to become aware of this, I'm sure. I know you will agree with that.
Thanks.
Can you talk a little bit about the case that Monsanto already brought against Vermont? I mean, how do we expect that that's going to turn out? And isn't that going to kind of undermine everybody's efforts here in Oregon and other states that try to bring, bring justice to the issue?
So I'm actually not as up to speed as one would hope. I'm a little bit like Rhett in that Food and Water Watch is a national organization, and we definitely got people who are in D.C. and working in the Northeast who could answer that question far better than I can right now. But I can say that Vermont knew they were going to be sued. This is not one of those things where the state legislature was like, oh, let's do this really great thing. It'll just go into law and we'll like make history and it'll be great. Like they knew going into it, they'd be sued. We wrote, that actually gives me a chance to talk about something I cut out of my speech, which is the initiative itself is written by an attorney, by more than one attorney, for the whole point of making it legally defensible. So that we enter into these battles knowing that we want democracy to win. We want to push these things through with a democratic process. And if the corporations want to turn around and sue, we're going to have something really like watertight and legally defensible. And it's really commendable that a state legislature got something all the way through to the governor and he signed it knowing that they were going to be slapped with a lawsuit over it. And they must be very confident that it's a sound law, right? We're allowed to make laws in this country. You know, it's what it's American, right? And so something that is different in Oregon as well with the ballot initiative specifically is we did clean up some of the language. This is like tangential to your question, but I think it's important to know because people are often wondering what was different between what's different in Oregon. This is another fairly substantial difference. We cleaned up the ballot language so that there are no more exemptions. The opposition had a lot of fun writing ads about all the things that wouldn't be labeled because we listed out all the things that wouldn't be labeled. And it turns out that all the things that wouldn't be labeled are all the things that currently are not labeled. Mm-hmm. So we're like, everything that's labeled gets labeled. And everything, you know, and that's it, right? We just took the exemption language out because it was confusing and it gave the opposition some low-hanging fruit. And there's a few other, like we cleaned up some other parts of the language as well. The ballot title reads a lot better. It doesn't say it will label some genetically engineered foods. It took the word some out. We got the word misbranded removed because, I mean, it confuses everyone. It confuses voters. It confuses me. So, I mean, like the language of the actual ballot title and description is a lot cleaner as well. And we made it clear that farmers would not be held liable as well, which it was clear. That was true of both previous initiatives. It just wasn't written as clearly. So either way, the ballot initiative in Oregon is even more clean than the other two. But I think, yeah, we know and anticipate when we pass rules like this, whether it's through the legislative process or through the popular vote, that corporations can and likely will sue, and we will hopefully and likely win. And that's what makes the victory even sweeter, actually. So yeah, I mean, I think also how Vermont plays out will probably indicate how Oregon plays out. I mean, I don't know what the timing will be, but if they lose in Vermont, maybe they won't try here. I mean, I don't, you know what I mean? It's like, I think a lot of that's up in the air, but it's something that is definitely anticipated in these processes.
Good evening. Thank you for being here and sharing this wonderful information with us. I have a question that's for anyone who has knowledge, but particularly Julia, because you addressed the fast track provision before, and I wonder if you might address a little bit more of the political mechanics behind that, because do I understand correctly, for example, that fast track is not the case now, that is something that would have to be voted on in itself or passed by Congress as a legislative procedure. And it seems to me that if I were a lawmaker on either side of the aisle, a fast-track provision like that applied to a massive trade agreement like this would be a real deal-breaker in itself. To think that I would be pressured to vote up or down on something that has such incredible and far-reaching implications in so many realms would take, if anything, it would be the opposite. It would take extra long consideration and study, much more than they get to do on most measures that they have to vote on. And so it gives me a false hope that it would be voted down because for the very reason that they wouldn't have chance to properly consider all of the provisions and implications of the measure as written.
I mean, like quick 2 cents and then you. I mean, it was written during the Nixon administration when trade policy was a very different thing and it had mostly to do with tariffs and it was just a simpler, different time. But there are reasons why people would choose fast track. And I'm going to Elizabeth take this one because she's the fast track expert.
Well, first off, if you were a lawmaker, I would definitely vote for you. So, I think the reason why our members of Congress unfortunately vote for Fast Track, which, by the way, a little bit of history behind that. Fast Track expired in 2007. So Congress would have to, in fact, vote for it in order for it to go through. And basically what Fast Track does, by the way, Fast Track is also Trade Promotion Authority. Those two things are the same. Basically what it does is it allows the executive branch to sign off on the trade deal before members of Congress really get a chance to look at it and before the public gets to see any of the negotiating text in an official capacity. We know that there's been leaked chapters of the TPP text. And it limits Congress's ability to look it over and to have debate to 90 days. And then they are, even if they see something that's completely outrageous, pro-Monsanto language, anti-consumer rights language, they can't do anything about it. Amendments are completely forbidden. So that's why Fast Track is so dangerous. It's really the linchpin in the TPP fight. And I'm gonna hand it over to Madeline.
Yeah, and just in addition on the Smart Track, when we met with Wyden's guy, we got into one of the inner sanctum rooms, not the, but one of them. He did say that, well, it wouldn't have amendments. You wouldn't be allowed to have amendments because, you know, this is a trade deal and you're dealing with all these different countries and of course you can't amend it. So that's not on the table with Smart Track either, okay? The amendment is not on the table and that's the chair of the Finance Committee of the Senate.
And I think it's really important to, so you asked, your part of your question was why? Why would they choose, we can't, I feel like my voice is echoing. The reason why, I mean, we can't crawl into their brains and know for sure, but if you're gonna be voting on something super controversial that you can't actually, that's very hard to make amendments to and change, right? Something like trade policy that could be really, really unpopular. I think it looks attractive to members of Congress to just be able to abdicate that responsibility, be able to be like, you know what? I had to vote on it, you know, because there was all the stuff in there that was good that needed to happen. I had to take the good with the bad. I couldn't make amendments. I just, you know, it's a way of being able to kind of deflect, right? It's like, oh, I had to pass the trade policy. I had to do, Fast Track because there was no other. It kind of just makes it easier to make what looks like a really unpopular decision. But I think it's a bit of a catch-22 because it's so unpopular to do it that if we catch that, if we do really good organizing, it's really hard to defend themselves when they say yes to Fast Track. But that's I think that's why they agreed to it, is it enables them to just kind of not have to deal with actually grappling with really difficult and controversial trade policy. It's a theory.
Sorry I missed the beginning, but my question is, on my way over here, there were sidewalk writing all the way through town, like from down by Apple up to here, about Google TPP, and I, like, so does Google support it? Or because there was something about Google bringing one of their markets to Portland, and I, from what little I knew of it, I agreed with that, but what was the Google TPP thing all over the sidewalk about? Thanks.
I don't know.
I mean,
but in terms of Google, they want to bring in fiber optics and do and go head-to-head with Comcast in terms of your video to the home. And the city council is giving away right-of-ways and giving them free permits and all that because they really hate Comcast. But I think people should be a little bit wary of that. Seriously, just because they oppose Comcast doesn't necessarily mean that they're good too.
Right.
Although the enemy of my enemy sometimes is my friend. But,
well, no.
But at any rate, Google's all over the place in Oregon. And they're using our fresh water. I mean, they love the fresh water there in the Dalles and over there in Prineville, so.
And they might also just say, be saying, Google TPP, look it up. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing about Google, it's become like a descriptor for look something up. So I'm pretty sure they're telling you to just look up the TPP so you know what it is and get you riled up. That's my guess. Yeah, Google it. Just look it up. That's my theory.
No, Google wrote TPP.
correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't a national politician quoted as saying if they saw what was in the trade agreement, they wouldn't want it? I'm paraphrasing, of course. Shouldn't that be the headline on every flyer? We're not dealing with mental giants here. These people, I don't know, do they realize how stupid they sound when they say things like this? But yeah, I just think that, and I guess my question is that true? Is that something that's been said? And it seems to apply to GMO as well.
So that was most likely Representative Grayson, who was the first representative to see the TPP text. And one of his quotes, one of my favorites, is that he's read the TPP and he describes it as a punch to the face for the middle class. He's a very colorful representative. But it's true. It really is going to kill the middle class in this country. And as you've heard, our environmental laws, our access to affordable medicine, and much, much more. So it's a really scary thing.
I'm very impressed that we have a representative of the local, of a national union, the world's probably largest environmental group, and that Food and Water Watch is now in Australia, you said, and other places?
We're in Europe and in Central America, yeah.
One of the things that really bothers me about this, and I've been following this for quite a while, speaking of Google, I signed up for a Google alert to get daily stuff from all over the world about what's gone on with the TPP. And to be quite honest with you, I stopped looking at it because it was so depressing, because some of the same things you're talking about, most all of the same things you're talking about, are happening in these other countries. The thing that bothered me about it was two things. One, country versus country, where we're talking about a corporate takeover, and labor, environment, health. I only see about one out of maybe four of those alerts that talks about people like us in these other countries that are doing this, the NGOs. So my question is, for labor, for environment, for health, what kind of contact are your organizations or others like yours making with these other countries, same type of organizations?
Well, CWA is part of the International Trade Unions Council. We, in fact, the executive board last year had the head of the Australian Labor Council at one of our meetings. And we talk about, okay, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, organizing in various fields, not just telecom, but also banking. We're the only country that doesn't have unions in the finance industry. We are really one of the few countries, and so other countries are very concerned about that because they don't want to see that happen in their countries for many reasons, but one of which is all the dirty tricks that finance does here, they know about it because they're union in other places. It's a lot more easy to regulate it. So, I mean, I think in terms of international, it's a lot easier to be international now than it ever has been. In terms of global policy, I really feel like the movement's kind of catching up on that in one way. In another way, you know, the movement's always had these international social forums, right? Where that's who comes to the social forums, is environmental, health and safety, labor, NGOs. And we talk about, okay, what are we going to do about this? And we've been talking about it. I think that, our cross-border work when NAFTA first was passed was really essential. We once had where's Peter? Peter Parks. Anyway, we once had there was a labor dispute in the Mexican maquila over. Making those what are those things called? The containers that they put on container ships. Okay, Hajin. They were they had a labor dispute. We went down there. It was payday, and almost every single person in line to pick up their check had a missing thumb or a missing finger or had a broken leg or whatever, because the working conditions were so terrible. The safety conditions were terrible. So they went on strike. They came up here. We worked it out with Longshoremen Local 8, and we shut down Terminal 6 for a couple of days in support of their strike. So, I mean, it is possible to do that, and we talk to, I mean, these are regular guys. I mean, we put our money together. We all threw in some money and got them the plane ticket up and back. But, you know, that's part of it. That's part of it, is to have regular workers talking to regular workers other places, you know, kind of like, you know, the busman's holiday where I went to Australia, and they have Australian cable splicers do the same thing that telephone cable splicers here in Oregon do. We have our smoko, we have our lunch, and so on. And, you know, you talk to people and you realize where we have a lot of things the same, okay? But I really think that our most important work is right here, is talking to people in our neighborhoods, talking to our coworkers, and so on, about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and to stop it in its tracks. And I guess I sound like a broken record, but honestly, that's our most important work here. There's no other important work. That's our most important work here.
I guess I would just add on the environmental front, you know, it's our folks in D.C. that do, you know, most of the negotiations, and, you know, Sierra Club doesn't have a branch in, you know, Brunei. You know, so the major problem on the environmental side, of course, is that in most of these countries, they don't have an Endangered Species Act. They don't have Forest Practices Act. So they're logging, they're fishing. You know, is virtually unregulated. So, I mean, it may even be that some environmental groups in some of those countries would see, you know, at least from their perspective, if there was some, you know, at least a pretense of some sort of regulation for once, you know, as part of the TPP, they might even see, you know, that as a slight step up. I mean, but for us, for sure, you know, that just allows, you know, those forests to be, you know, completely mowed down, you know, those fisheries to be just completely decimated, because they don't have the environmental laws to have to comply with like we do. But it's an interesting question. I'm actually going to check with my DC staff to see to what extent they've had conversations with environmental organizations in other countries.
And just to, I'll try to speak really briefly about, I mean, what Food and Water Watch does internationally is, it's really similar to what we do nationally. I mean, we have a large office in D.C. It's our headquarters, and then we have some other larger satellite offices in, like, Oakland, Chicago, Denver, and then satellite offices like mine, where it's like a one-person office for a two-state region. We got someone in New Mexico. We got someone in Maine. We have a large office in New York because fracking is huge and really important, and we need to win on banning fracking and protecting drinking water sources. In each of those places, I mean, our organization was founded by an organizer. So we really believe in building people power. And so with that looks very different in all these different locations. We work on the issue that matters the most in that region with the groups that are doing the important work and try to support that and augment that and help, you know, bring strategic organizing to campaigns to stop LNG exports and to help support those efforts and to support GMO labeling and to support these bans on fracking in Colorado. And then internationally, I know that in Europe, we do a lot of work with the European Union, you know, really raising the bar at the European Union level. So the organizers, you know, in the EU are doing very different kind of work than the organizing I'm doing, because that's the level at which they're working. And in Central America, and we've had an organizer in Bolivia who was there for the Cochabamba, the water wars that they had when they were forced to privatize. I mean, we have organizers who've been involved in these huge water privatization fights in the developing world. So the work looks different depending on where we are. But it's really all about making sure, and we're really trying to make sure that the systems that provide us with our water and our food are adequate, and that regulations are being enforced if they exist, and if they don't exist, that we have adequate regulation to begin with. And so that fight looks different in every location, but that fight also, we're only as strong as our coalitions. You know, I'm a one-person office with a large support team, you know, from the national group, but like we're as strong as our coalitions and our supporters here. So I think that's a big part of it. You have to work on issues that are important in the region you're in with the groups and the people that are doing the really good work.
So I think that's a good question to kind of talk briefly about. We got word that there's going to be another round of TPP negotiations in July 3rd through the 13th, and it was planned for Vancouver, BC. So yeah, it would be a great opportunity to visit our neighbors up north. And our allies with the Council of Canadians, which is a federation of unions, very similar to AFL-CIO, was organizing calls, getting both different organizations, civil society groups from the U.S. and throughout Canada, getting them on the call and talking about how can we do a rally, how can we do educational events, what can we be doing to really put pressure on these negotiators and let them know that people do not support these job-killing, environmentally damaging free trade agreements? They must have found out about our organizing, because just a couple hours before this forum, I got word that it's now been moved to Ottawa, Canada. But, you know, I think this is a really good example of, you know, they're scared of us. When they know people power, we're going to shut them down when we come together. You know, it is a very, very different time than the battle in Seattle, 1999. We had a year to organize. We're never going to see that again. And, you know, when we do start to organize, they've learned. They've learned that they can just move, and they have all the resources to be able to do that, to pick up a couple days beforehand and go somewhere else. So I say that only in that, you know, our fight, again, just like Madeline said, is right here. And we can pressure our members of Congress to oppose things like Fast Track, which, you know, essentially will defeat the TPP if we're able to stop Fast Track. And we were very successful because of the organizing done by many of the people in this room. We essentially killed that Fast Track legislation when it was introduced in January within a couple of weeks. We had people on the ground organizing, mobilizing just days after. And that's the kind of work that we're going to need to do in order to prepare for Smart Track, which is rumored to be introduced in November. Senator Wyden has already announced that he's planning to introduce that. And, you know, it's going to be the work that we do right now during election time that will prepare us for a victory on Smart Track after elections.
So you'll have to fit in your GMO volunteering around your Fast Track volunteering.
That's right. dual volunteering there.
No, it's Senator Merkley's up for re-election, and people should support him because he's been good on this issue this entire time.
I have a revolutionary thought that occurred a couple of days ago. I created a new term called speciescide. There's homicide, suicide, genocide. A direction we're heading with this conflict going on between the super rich and the ordinary citizenry is leading us eventually toward the species side, where human beings will no longer exist on the earth. So what we need to do is change the way we look at human beings and life on earth, such that social responsibility and human decency overrules and supersedes greed and the super rich who never get enough. So I'm wondering what you think of that idea, and how would we go about doing it? Is it going to take people taking to the streets and shutting down the system and starting anew, hopefully coming out the other end with a more socially responsible citizen, and we have control over the super rich and the greed heads who never get enough. What do you think of that idea? Species side.
Yes.
So I'm thinking we probably have time for one more question.
One more after me. That's very nice of you. I have one comment to make that I'm not sure we should try to answer, and then a specific question. The comment is that as we try to consider why a congressperson would consider fast track as not all that bad an idea, it really does permit that congressperson to avoid making very large numbers of large campaign contributors unhappy. Mr. Wyden has often given interesting answers to that statement, where he says, oh, I don't do that. Enough. I wanted to ask specifically regarding the ballot measure, GMO labeling. Is it also going to have something to do with GMOs that will relieve Jackson County of some of the pressure it is under?
I mean, they're really unrelated.
Okay, so it's not going to help the Jackson County thing at all.
No, yeah, I mean, they're really...
Not going to say that counties can regulate, which was reversed by the big deal with PERS and a couple of other things by the governor last fall.
Well, to be really clear, Jackson County does get to ban
GMOs. Jackson gets to
Josephine.
Do it. Josephine's questionable, and everybody else is done.
Right. And Josephine, I think Josephine County, I think... It's a symbolic win at this point in time, but I think there's talk about it possibly going to court, trying to say that, you know, that's completely unrelated.
Ballot measure is not going to reverse the thing.
It's the Monsanto rider. You're talking about SB 633. Yeah. So the bill strictly had to do with local regulation of agriculture, and GMO food labeling has nothing to do directly with agriculture. I mean, technically it's literally about consumer right to know. And so they're really, it doesn't even say whether or not GMOs are good or bad. It just simply is a regulation that requires that all food in our grocery stores has a label on it letting you know whether or not it contains genetically engineered ingredients. So it's, yeah, the bill was written before the SB 633 even existed anyway. But yeah, they're very separate issues.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I wanted to thank you for bringing two seemingly separate issues and drawing the connections to them. And that's really, really important. And sometimes, in fact, most of the time, on these issues, we regard them as single issues and not as a joint issue, and we need to develop that movement that joins them and sees the connection. So thank you very much for doing that. I was at the Healthcare for All Oregon annual conference this Saturday here at the church, and at the end I made an announcement about this forum, and I asked the people to raise their hands. And I asked, how many of you have heard of the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the TPP? And in that group of reasonably well-informed people, only about half of them raised their hands. And then I asked the same question with regard to the GMO labeling initiative, and about two-thirds raised their hands. So I was a little more encouraged about that. But that does show the value of doing these kinds of forums, so thank you. I don't know if you have collected signatures or had sign-in from people or not, but if not, I'm hoping that folks who are here might give your contact information, a phone number, a name, and an email address. Just write it down on something so that we can contact you again, because both of these issues are going to need support. The Trans-Pacific in particular is an issue which, you know, in the general population, no one has heard about it. The only way that that's going to change is if we are out there talking about it at public forums with our neighbors and so forth. So we need to have your contact information, is what I'm saying. Okay.
Yeah. So, there was a sign-up sheet that went around. Did people get the sign-up sheet? Okay.
All right. Definitely was making its way
around.
Okay,
good.
Okay.
And I think we should all just say David Delk from Alliance for Democracy. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And that was part two of a forum on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how this secretive free trade agreement will impact local efforts to ban GMOs. That was recorded on June 19th in Portland. Coming up next is Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman, and that is followed at 11:30 by the Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. She leads a conversation with Sarah Finger McDonald of the Oregon chapter leader Moms Demand Action. The group is dedicated to promoting health and safety and measures that could help to keep children safe from violence. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. It is just a little after 11 a.m., and you do have it tuned to KBOO in Portland.
Monday, August 18th at 6:30 p.m., join KBOO at the Clinton for a screening of Woodstock, The Director's Cut. This landmark concert film is the definitive record of that three-day cultural event. Director Michael Wadley worked with over 300 hours of footage to create his original 225-minute Director's Cut. Again, that's Woodstock, The Director's Cut at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation.